Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, April 30, 2018. A South Sudanese doctor says the health system in his country has collapsed.
Yes, the Juba Teaching Hospital is actually non-dysfunctional. It's not a functional unit. You go there, you are actually going to die.
And rebels loyal to Riek Machar free 10 aid workers abducted in South Sudan.
So we had two helicopters today that traveled to an area around Yei, South Sudan, where we collected the 10 aid workers. We had a team of three ICRC staff on board, including one doctor, and we transported them to Juba. And once again, thankfully, they are now safe and sound.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A Canadian-trained South Sudanese doctor who worked at Juba Teaching Hospital says some senior government officials are spending millions of dollars on medical referrals overseas. Dr. Mawena Kot says he has written letters for many government officials who are paid thousands of dollars by the government for medical treatment outside South Sudan. Akot says some of the officials remain in South Sudan after receiving the money.
Actually, I did my basic medical degree in Egypt, University of Alexandria, and then I did my postgraduate training here in Canada.
Okay, so you did the specialization in Canada?
Yes.
And what was your specialization in then?
I did family medicine and nuclear medicine.
Okay, that's good. So, and when did you start working in South Sudan?
2013.
You made some statements over the weekend talking about how some government officials come to you for referrals, and these referrals could be a tune of thousands of dollars. Could you tell us a little bit? Just give us a situation where you have written a referral to a senior government official.
Well, myself, I'm one of the medical committee that refer people abroad. So when people come to me, and usually mostly they are the government officials, they tell me I want to go to Germany for treatment, or my wife want to go, or my children want to go. So I make the referral, and then the three of us have to sign that letter. And then it is taken to the Minister of Health. And then it is brought back to me to sign it. What I know is now we are talking about the economic situation of the country. The most draining system in the country for the hard currency is actually the Ministry of Health. Because when I refer these people abroad, sometimes they take 50,000 euros or 100,000 euros to go to Germany.
But who gives them that money? Where do they get that money from?
The money, actually, you can access it in two ways, either through the Ministry of Finance or through the Central Bank of South Sudan.
And who gives the approval for this money to be paid to these individuals who are referred to go abroad? Who approves the money?
In most cases, what I know so far is that the SPLA, like the veterans, are the most draining because they go through the Ministry of Finance and they get the approval. And then the Office of the President, because in the Office of the President, there is no ceiling. You can ask for how much you want, and it will be given to you.
So what you're telling me is, let me understand this correctly. You're telling me that if you sign a referral for somebody to go overseas, a senior government official, so then they go to the office of the president to request for the money?
Yes, and they are given.
And who signs these letters in the office of the president?
What I can cite here is just the example of the spokesperson for the president, Mr. Atanyuek Atany. I refer him abroad 4 times, and each time he takes 50,000 euros. So that is 200,000 euros for just himself.
And what about the other, I mean, you are just citing one government official here. What are the cases of others? Because this, yes. this sounds a little bit serious and scandalous in nature.
No, I'm just speaking the truth. And those generals, they know. You know, I refer advisors, I refer generals, and they get the money.
So you were a government consultant, doctor?
Yes.
So everything to do with the government, they will consult you?
Yes.
And so tell us a little bit about the situation of Juba Teaching Hospital. We hear that that hospital has its own issues. There is a joke in Juba that you go to Juba Hospital when you're not sick and you come out very sick.
Yes, Juba Teaching Hospital is actually non-dysfunctional. It's not a functional unit. You go there, you are actually going to die.
But you were working there. What did you do to improve the situation? I mean, I'll put you on a spot here. You were working in that hospital for many years, from 2013 until you left.
Yes.
What did you do to improve the situation as a doctor?
I'll tell you what I did. During the war, I was the head of the medical team there, and I tried to mainstream to make strategies that will save our lives, the life of the people that come to the Juba Teaching Hospital, according to my experience in Canada.
That's Dr. Maureen Akot, a South Sudanese doctor who left Juba last month and is now in Canada. In part two of my interview with Dr. Akot, he talks to us about the status of some senior government officials in South Sudan. The former health minister in former Northern Bahr al-Ghazal says the remarks by Dr. Akot about President Salva Kiir's health status is not true. Tong Deng says Dr. Akot has never worked in South Sudan's presidential medical unit. As Atit reports for VOA from Juba, Deng admits South Sudan's health facility is scrambling.
Deng says Akot has been working for the last 3 years as a consultant physician at Juba Teaching Hospital and had no access to the medical records of senior government officials. He says doctors are obligated by their medical ethics not to disclose information about their patients.
Dr. Mayuen have no access to the President Kiir record. He doesn't know anything about it. He has not been a medical doctor of President Kiir. So there are doctors who are dealing with the President. I know them because I have been working with the Minister of Health, and I know very well who are the ones working there. Number two, that interview of Dr. Mayuen, I watched it live. I download the video and I watch it, and I saw it was more politically motivated. It was not a medical interview in such.
Deng says Dr. Akot has no justification whatsoever to disclose anyone's medical history without legal order to do so, and likely has hurt his practice with his comments about the president's health.
There will be no patient that will trust him to go to see him, because that information has gone already everywhere in the internet. And now, patients will be very careful to see Dr. Mayuen, because he has already put the life of the patient in danger, and nobody will want to go there.
Deng says, in 2016, the South Sudan Ministry of Health transferred Dr. Akot to Awili State Hospital, but the doctor rejected the transfer and took up a job in a private clinic in Juba's Gudele neighborhood. But Deng agrees with Dr. Akot that South Sudan's healthcare system has deteriorated, part due to insufficient medical practitioners and insecurity caused by the ongoing war. He says even if the war ends, it will take several years for the healthcare sector to recover in South Sudan.
You will have a population of 100,000 run by one doctor. And this is something that cannot be solved in a short time. Both of the health issues are not definitely being settled well in South Sudan because we don't have that sufficient medical facilities. We don't have enough doctors.
Deng says South Sudan's health ministry has sponsored dozens of medical students to study so that they fill up the gap. He says he was aware that Dr. Akot would be leaving the country.
He talked to me in person, and he told me that the situation here is not very good financially, and he cannot tolerate to stay here. So the best thing is that he has to go back to Canada, and he work there until things improve. So by that time, he will see whether he will come back or not. But up to now, there is no anything that has changed from last month to today. So, and of course, if he come back, it's okay, he can come, and he will answer those questions to the people that he was accusing.
The former state health minister is calling on South Sudanese to ignore Dr. Akot's remarks about President Kiir's health status and continue to trust health practitioners in the country who, he says, are working tirelessly to provide medical services under difficult circumstances. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
10 aid workers who went missing last week around Yei Town have returned to Juba today. The International Red Crescent Committee says it facilitated their return. Ayen Dengbior has more from Washington.
The SPLM in opposition has released 10 aid workers that were detained last week and handed them over to the International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, who facilitated their release.
And we as the ICRC are relieved. I mean, as a result of the operation that took place today, these 10 aid workers are now in Juba. They're safe, they're sound, and they're able to return to their families and their loved ones.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, says the 10 aid workers were detained while on an assessment mission near Yei in central Equatoria. They were all national humanitarians who worked for UN OCHA, UNICEF, the South Sudanese Development Organization, ACROSS, a Christian organization, Plan International, and Action Africa Help. Lompal Gabriel, the SPLMIO spokesman, says the aid workers were detained because his troops could not verify their identities.
If you're coming to our territory, you need to consult with us. If you don't consult with us, we don't know your intention. We need to know why, what you're coming to do in our territory. You tell us that we are coming to ABCD. That will happen even when they're leaving the government territory. They always, when he was leaving the government territory, they seek permission. Then they are given permission to go.
Paul says the release was delayed because of communication issues.
Our field commanders, our field officers on the ground were not in contact with us. You know, network around here, we are not able to access network. That's right. They didn't have phone calls. We had to move our force, our general, from all the way in Congo, close to Congo, which is taking about 2-3 days walk to where that incident happened.
This month, a humanitarian worker was shot and killed while returning to check on a health clinic that had been looted in Lair County, according to OCHA. Earlier this month, an NGO vehicle carrying 5 aid workers, which UN OCHA says was clearly marked with the Catholic Organization for Relief Development Aid logo, was shot at by armed men along the Nyaldu Bentu Road. Opposition forces held 7 South Sudan Health Association aid workers for 20 days last month. OCHA says they were traveling from Kupera County to Lanya County to deliver supplies to health centers serving thousands of people in need in Koyoki, Kupera, Limuru, and Wuji areas. The ICRC facilitated the logistics of today's transfer.
So we had 2 helicopters today that traveled to an area around Yei, South Sudan, where we collected the 10 aid workers. We had a team of 3 ICRC staff on board, including 1 doctor, and we transported them to Juba. And once again, thankfully, they are now safe and sound in Juba and are able to return to their lives, return to their family.
OCHA says at least 100 aid workers have been killed in South Sudan since conflict began there in December 2013. OCHA did not respond to emails or return phone calls in time for this broadcast. Ayen Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, civil society activists continue to struggle in Uganda.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which African city would you most like to visit and why?
Johannesburg. It's really a nice place to chill in because I have a relative there and they really tell me about something like that. The beaches, the restaurants.
Bulawayo in Zimbabwe. You see, Bulawayo has got one of the rare kinds of streets. There is a street called Sorbon Street and it is more than 10 kilometers and it is straight. No curve, no corner. It is just straight.
I like to visit Alexandria, the city of Pharaoh, the city where the pyramids are found.
To be there and I be shown by a specialist the line of Equator, where it passes. That is the most reason why I like to first visit Ghana, Accra.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese civil society groups and non-governmental organizations say they face many challenges as they struggle to assist their people. The activists claim they have difficulties getting official recognition in Uganda, and sometimes they are also receiving threats from people suspected to be South Sudan government agents. Simon Peter Apiku reports for VOA from Kampala.
Leaders of these organizations say, despite these challenges, they are determined to continue providing services to their people. Simon Chow is an operations manager for a non-profit called the South Sudanese Orphans and Widows Care Foundation. Chow says he has not been able to register his organization in Uganda. He claims Ugandan officials rejected the name he had chosen for the organization.
So when we went to register the organization, they actually refused the idea of the word SS, which in our idea it was supposed to stand for South Sudan, because that was the target. Now they refused that. They said no, we can't register an organization here in Uganda bearing a name South Sudan.
South Sudanese activist John Machek says his organization, the Africa Youth Leadership Forum, has also been having some difficulties. He claims some South Sudanese in Uganda have taken sides in the ongoing conflict in the country, often along political and ethnic lines, and that makes it difficult for his non-profit to offer services.
I may be having experience and I would want to share with other youth, but since they know I'm from this region, they don't have willingness to come and share those values I have together as South Sudanese. So they always look at me as an enemy.
Machek claims his group has been trying to mentor and train youth, particularly senior secondary and university students, on how to be good leaders. Unlike Machek's organization, Daniel Poe of the Youth for Peace and Democracy claims agents of the South Sudanese government have been following him.
We face a lot of threat, especially from the government in South Sudan because of the kind of the work we are doing. So it's never easy for us to work here in Uganda. But so we do it underground because of commitment, and you know, we tend to take the risk so that we work with the community and know what is affecting them. So it's not safe at all to work in this in Uganda.
Nyajima Manyang, who works for the International Youth for Africa organization, agrees the conflict in her country has polarized South Sudanese society along ethnic affiliations. But she says she will not let that situation to prevent her efforts to empower women and promote gender equality amongst refugees in Uganda.
I encourage the women to come up and not to fear anything. We are all equal. What a man can do, a woman can also do. And then we also encourage them to go to school. And if the language English is the problem, you can also start by joining English course if you have something little.
Paul says threats of arrest will not stop civil society groups from advocating for change in South Sudan.
We know what we are doing is the right thing, and we are committed to do this. So despite all the threats and all the intimidation that are coming, so we are not going to give up. We shall continue working for the people of South Sudan.
South Sudanese organizations and civil society groups operating in Uganda say, in addition to these challenges, they are struggling to mobilize resources they need to continue delivering services to their people, especially in areas not served by national and international organizations in Uganda. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Piku in Kampala.
Some editors at private media houses in Juba have welcomed the recent report of the Press Freedom Index by the media watchdog Reporters Without Borders, which ranked South Sudan at 154th out of 180 countries around the world. Reporters Without Borders say South Sudan government has prevented journalists from covering issues linked to the ongoing conflict. For VOA News, Wake, Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Reporters Without Borders says South Sudan's authorities sometimes restrict foreign journalists from covering issues including the ongoing fighting. The report accused South Sudan of cracking down on media outlets. Kong Pal Chang is the station manager of the Juba-based iRadio and the chairperson of the South Sudan Editors Forum. Pal says South Sudan has moved one step forward in this year's Press Freedom Index. He says he remains hopeful that the media landscape in South Sudan will change.
It's a good news, and also it gives us hope that we are going in the right direction, and hopefully the media environment in South Sudan will improve or change. We will see change.
Pal says he thinks the media environment has improved slightly because of efforts by the media authority, which regulates the work of journalists in the country.
Issues related to media that used to be addressed or handled by national security are now handled by media authority. And I can say they are being handled amicably with understanding. Personally, as somebody who has a lot of experience in this, in media relation with the government in South Sudan, it is almost 1 year now since I visited the Blue House or the National Security Building. We used to be summoned by national security.
China, Singapore, Russia, Rwanda, Malaysia, Ethiopia, and Sudan are among some of the 36 countries with poor records of press freedom. Pal says he believes a series of atrocities committed by armed groups in South Sudan have contributed to the country's ranking in the Press Freedom Index.
This year in February, United Nations has released a report on freedom of expression in South Sudan, and there were so many issues that were raised. And I think it's upon us, we South Sudanese, especially people in the government officials, especially our brothers working at media authority, that when you deny foreign journalists to enter into your country, that one alone is a negative point to you. They weigh the positive part of what you are doing and the negative part of what you are doing. And South Sudan is not exempted. It's a part of this global village. So it has to abide by the universal law.
Anna Namiriano is the chief editor at the Juba Monitor. She agrees that there are some improvements on the press freedoms in South Sudan. Namiriano says authorities should allow citizens to freely exercise their rights to freedom of speech. She says the National Security Service summoned her last month for publishing a photo about oil pollution in the northern part of the country.
If you are asking, like interviewed even citizens of this country, some people fear to give information because they say, if I just give information, maybe I will be taken what to the place where I will not know myself. So if you want to move forward in this country, let us just leave somebody to talk free.
Pal also says journalists and media houses should follow ethical guidelines for reporting news in South Sudan. The managing director of the media authority, Elijah Alierkwai, declined to comment on the Press Freedom Index report, saying he has not read it. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The Press Freedom Index ranked South Sudan number 144 out of 180 countries around the world. Over the last decades, sanctions regime have been increasingly used to bolster international human rights and international humanitarian law, including targeted sanctions on entities and individuals in South Sudan. Researcher Sophie Have of the Georgetown Institute for Women, Peace and Security tells South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam that according to her findings in a new report, those sanctions are often inconsistent compared to the reality on the ground.
It's been quite inconsistent because you have several sanctions regimes at the cartel level where you have massive instances of sexual violence, as in Sudan, for instance. You have massive reports testifying high level of sexual violence used as a weapon of war, and yet it's completely disregarded by the Security Council and not taken into account at all in the sanctions regime. It's also inconsistent because within one regime, you will have numerous reports on sexual violence used as a weapon of war, and yet the Security Council will take years to implement a designation criteria on that basis, and even longer to impose sanctions on relevant individuals.
Our reporters in South Sudan in particular have heard a number of times in different, in POC camps and in other places, the refugee camps, even outside South Sudan, but near the border, where this continues to happen, even inside the camps. And the sanctions are there, perhaps, but they're just not being enforced. So what does the UN do, or what do authorities do that are on the ground?
So first, we have to distinguish between sexual violence perpetrated by armed groups and by the government in South Sudan against against the different ethnies, and sexual violence that happens inside the camps, inside the IDP camps or the refugee camps. And it's a completely different subject. Sanctions at the Security Council level only target the key stakeholders that are ordering or tolerating sexual violence when used as a weapon of war, meaning that you are going to use sexual violence to terrorize the population, to intensify the hostilities, to forcibly displace the population.
You're referring to the soldiers of the government's army, correct?
Yes.
Of course, that we have heard reports that rebel forces have done the same thing with women, but I just want to get into the weeds here more of it. Was your group able to actually assess on the ground in South Sudan how big of a problem this is? And if so, what did they say?
What we did as a methodology of research is that we informed the research by interviews with a lot of experts on South Sudan. Informed by interviews, not on the ground, but interviews with people who were on the ground, informed us that you have sanctions in South Sudan, but it's a little tricky because, unfortunately, the Security Council is quite reluctant to impose sanctions in South Sudan at the moment, because you have some members in the Security Council who believe that imposing sanctions would spoil any possible peace negotiations.
You have that argument, and we've heard that argument, though, for years, and a lot of people would say to that, you can make that argument, but nothing's really changed anyway, so what's the hurt in trying to,
I completely agree with you, right? I think that this argument that sanctions would spoil the negotiations is completely irrelevant because the negotiations have not evolved. Right?
That's Sophie Harvey of the Georgetown Institute for Women, Peace and Security. She was speaking to Carol Van Dam in Washington. That brings us to the end of our show for this Monday. We're going to leave you with the song You Are Not Alone by Kay Danks. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
And see, in my society, you made me lose my ability. You made me disabled in mind. Better old failure, spine line. You made me cut myself out of my youth. As if I'm injured, or illness, but not. As if I'm weak and low, silent, but not. You made me unable to operate normally, temporarily, unable to move and think fairly. You made me very emotional ill. I saw you need me to be unsuccessful in life. That's why I'm unaccessible. You made me fail to think of any practical solution. Soon owns a surprise of revolution. Yeah, I'm standing here. Cause I can do it now. Cause I can do it now. Yeah, standing there. I have to stand alone for a reason why. You made me blind not to see anything. You made me deaf not to hear anything. You lock my nose not to...